Okay, why don't we go ahead and get started? So I understand that attendance was down a little bit last night at the recitation section. I'm hoping people will make that up on Thursday.
Yeah, it's probably because half of us are going tomorrow.
Yeah, I hope so, yeah.
Yeah.
You can't like either.
I thought we had that covered with the two sections.
I'll laugh up Tuesday and Thursday.
Well, there's always Saturday night at midnight. When students used to, early in when I first came here, students used to complain about, oh, we can't, you know, ever make your office hours. I said, or we can never find a time to make up a class. I said, let's start at midnight on Saturday and work our way backwards. And never had any problems after that. How many people can't make either Tuesday or Thursday? Just one. He's got office hours as well, and all the notes and all that are on the website. I'm curious, could you email me what classes are conflicting? You don't have to tell me now, but I'm just curious what, because usually we try to work this out so that students who take this class have one of those two nights open. Okay, so today I want to talk about a few topics which, generally speaking, are related to how we model systems with differential equations and with difference equations. We'll start with difference equations, which are what we use for discrete time systems, and then we'll end with differential equations, which is what we use for continuous time systems, and then we'll show how you can actually use difference equations to find numerical solutions to differential equations. So let's start with linear constant coefficient difference equations. There's actually a lot of things about discrete time systems which are much simpler than continuous time systems. And one of the nice things about one nice example of that are difference equations. Discrete time difference equations are actually very easy to manipulate because they just involve simple algebra. Differential equations are a little harder until we introduce things like Laplace transform. So we can model the input-output behavior of a discrete time, linear time invariant system. Okay, so what does that mean? So discrete time, I think we understand. What does it mean for the system to be linear? The output should scale with the input. That's sort of a nice compact way of describing it. And then what about time invariant?
Doesn't matter where I was.
Right. And so we can model these discrete time system using an nth order input output difference equation. This is often called a digital filter. And so on the right here, we show a block diagram. We apply x of n to this system, and we get y of n as output. And then on the left-hand side, we have this equation, y of n plus the sum from I is equal to 1 to n of a sub I, y of n minus I, is equal to the sum from I equals 0 to m of b sub I, x of n minus I. Now, you know, that's, for those of you not comfortable yet with the mathematical notation, the summations are just a shorthand way of writing out these, you know, multiple terms. The a's and b's are just constants with an index of I. And we'll normally write equations in this form where we'll have y of n is equal to things on the right-hand side. And on the right-hand side, we'll lump things associated with y in one summation and things associated with x in the second summation. So we have this equation. We can move that first summation over to the right and write y of n is equal to minus the sum from I is equal to 1 to n of a sub I, y of n minus I, and so forth. Now let's consider a simple example of this. So we're going to take y of n is equal to 1.5 times y of n minus 1. So when I is 1, we have 1.5 y of n minus 1 minus y of n minus 2. So a sub 2 is going to be equal to 1 plus 2 times x of n minus 2. So b0 is 0, b1 is 0, b2 is equal to 2 x of n minus 2. So a simple difference equation, that's an example of that general equation. And what we're going to do is we're going to assume zero initial conditions, meaning that the previous values of y for when n is equal to zero, y of minus one and y of minus two is equal to zero. And we're going to apply an impulse function, delta of n, to this system, and we're going to compute the output. Now, the initial conditions being zero, later you'll see this is the equivalent in the discrete world of a situation like a capacitor is discharged, for example. So let's just go sort of step through the calculations, which are not too complicated. We have, when n is equal to zero, we have x of n is equal to one because this is a delta function. X of n minus one is equal to zero because the initial conditions are zero, and delta, this function is only non-zero when n is equal to zero. And then we have x of n minus two is zero, and then y of n is zero, y of n minus one, y of n minus two. So the initial conditions are zero. So we have zero, 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 so y of n is equal to zero. So the first calculation was not too bad. Now, at time equals one, at n is equal to one, x of n becomes zero. We take this value of x of n and we move it down here because it's delayed by one sample. We take this value and move it down here. Then we have y of n minus one, we move down here, and y of n, we move down here. So we have, the only thing now we need to compute is this y of n. Y of n is 1.5 times y of n minus 1, which is 0, plus minus y of n minus 2, which is 0, times 2 times x of n minus 2, which is 0. So y of n is also 0. So why do we actually get why do we get 0 values for y of n, even though x of n is non-zero at n is equal to 0?
Because the function doesn't, like, y of n doesn't depend on x of n.
Right.
I mean, like, yeah.
This is essentially an example of this time invariance. You could say that the output is dependent on x delayed by 2. So we would expect some output when n is equal to 2. So we can again go through the same calculation. X of n is 0. Copy down x of n minus 1, x of n minus 2. Y of n minus 1, y of n minus 2. Now we're going to compute y of n. Y of n is equal to 1.5 times y of n minus 1, which is 0, minus y of n minus 2, which is 0, plus 2 times x of n minus 2. Well, now we have a 1 here. 2 times 1 gives us 2. So I think you can see the calculations are pretty trivial. It just involves being systematic. I'll show you in a minute how to do this in MATLAB, which makes it even easier. But we can go on and essentially get values of y. Now, what's interesting about this system is that if you carry the calculations out, you're going to see that the output is not going to go to zero because we have this feedback loop that seems to be continuing to amplify the output. And we're going to talk about that a lot throughout the semester. That gets into a topic we call stability. But the nice thing about this is all difference equations can be handled this way, so there's really nothing complicated about this other than a lot of bookkeeping. Now, I guess I should say one other thing. By applying delta of n to this system and computing y, what are we obtaining? What do we call this? This is a very special function that we talked about last time. If you apply an input to a system, an impulse to the system, and you measure the output, what do you get? What do we call that?
H of n.
H of n, which we call the, you apply an impulse, you get a response. We call that the impulse response. So this is the impulse response of this system, and we learned last time how we can use convolution to compute the same thing. So alternately, I could have given you the impulse response to the system, and asked you to compute the output, and you could have done that through convolution. Now, difference equations in MATLAB are pretty easy to deal with. So first I'll show you some code, and then I'll actually show you a function call to do the same thing. So on the right here, we have code that allows us to do this computation. The first four lines there essentially set up the vectors for the input x and the output y. And then the key computation is this recursive computation here. Y of I is equal to A times Y of N minus I plus B times X of N minus I. So this loop, this for I equals N plus 1, computes the difference equation. And that's sort of the key step here. Now, you don't actually have to code that in MATLAB because you have in MATLAB a function to do that. We have many different ways in MATLAB that we can compute inputs and outputs. So the way you really do this is you set up the coefficient vector, you set up the input and the outputs, and then you apply that to this function recurse, which takes as arguments the A's and the B's, the X's and the Y's, and computes into Y the output. Then you can go ahead and plot Y and label the plots. And there's nothing special about doing this with the impulse response. We could actually do the unit step response, and we can do sine waves and cosine waves and things like that. So this is one example of how you can solve a difference equation in MATLAB, and you'll have a chance to practice this with some of the homework problems. Now, what we want to do next is to look at the complete response of a first-order equation to an input. And you may recall from your differential equations analysis, when you have a differential equation, you want to compute the output. You go through a series of steps. And what are some of those steps? The output's always the sum of two components. If you go back to your math classes and you remember how you solved differential equations, the output was always the sum of two responses, right? So let's sort of walk through that. What we'll see in a moment is that the output essentially becomes the sum of two things. One is the response due to the initial conditions. If the system has initial conditions, like a capacitor is charged, even if you don't supply an input, you're going to see an output due to the discharge of that capacitor. And then the other part is the response due to the forcing function, the input. And together, they comprise what we call the complete response of the system. And we'll constantly talk about this semester, that those two outputs, because it's a linear system, sum to give you the complete output. So consider the first order linear difference equation. Y of n is equal to A times Y of n minus 1 plus B times X of n. This is a very simple first order difference equation. And its response, we will see shortly, is essentially an exponential type response. This is very similar to what you get with a first order differential equation. But let's assume that the initial condition, Y of minus 1, is not equal to 0. So when n is equal to 0, if you look at that top equation, if I ask you to solve that equation when n is equal to 0, the first thing you'll tell me is, well, you may know x of 0, but you need to know what is going on with y of minus 1. And we'll assume y of minus 1 is not equal to 0. Oftentimes, when you're coding these kinds of things on a computer, you may forget to zero out the memory. And you'll encounter problems in your solution because you forget to zero memory. When you're doing these kinds of equations in assembly language in particular, like maybe for your senior design projects and such, you'll pay special attention to making sure that you clear the memory or you retain the state of the memory properly Otherwise, you get that those values in memory will cause you to get the wrong output. So we have some initial condition, y minus 1 is not equal to 0. So we can go ahead and compute y of 0. That's just going to be a times y of minus 1 plus b times x of 0. We can go ahead then and compute y of 1, which is a times y of 0 plus b times x of 1. Well, we know what y of 0 is from the previous line, so we can make that substitution and write a times the quantity a times y of minus 1 plus b times x of 0, and then we have also b times x of 2. So we can simplify this a little bit and write a squared times y of minus 1 plus a times b times x of 0 plus b times x of 1. This should be x of 1. So we can repeat this. Now we can write that y of 2 is going to be a times y of 1 plus b times x of 2, and we can write that a times, now we can take this expression for y of 2, for y of 1 rather, and this should be b times x of 2. So we can again simplify this by just multiplying a through and summing similar terms, and we have a cubed times y of minus 1 plus a squared times bx of 0 plus abx of x of 1 plus b times x of 2. So if we continue this, we see a couple trends here. One, we see that this initial condition is always seems to be carried through, and it's going to be increasingly being multiplied by a. So we're going to have a to the power n times this initial condition, and then we're going to have this other term that's sort of carried through, because that's going to ripple through the rest of the sum. So the first part of this response, which is the part that does not depend on x of n, this is what we call the response due to the initial condition. And because the initial condition is non-zero, we're going to have a term in the output associated to that initial condition. That's essentially, again, like a capacitor discharging. Now we see something interesting here. If the value of A is greater than 1, what's going to happen to this component of the output that's due to the initial condition?
It's going to continue to grow.
It's going to continue to grow, which is going to make the system unstable. So later we'll see that a stability condition for this circuit or this system is that A be less than 1. And then we have these terms which are associated with the input, and that's essentially the component of the response due to the forcing function x of n. And the overall response then is the sum of the part due to the initial condition and the part due to the input. And together they comprise the complete response of the system. Now later we'll see that these can be computed using something we'll call the Z-transform, which is very similar to Laplace transform. And the Z-transform, like the Laplace transform, converts the difference equation to an algebraic equation so that we can just solve for these inputs and outputs using simple algebra. We can also sometimes solve these equations using summation tables, and we'll see a couple examples of that in the homework and see it later and a little bit later when we look more closely at these first order systems. Now let me next transition to continuous time systems for a moment, and then I'll show you how we can blend these two together to do numerical solutions for continuous time systems. So for continuous time systems, the analogy of the difference equation is a differential equation. Differential equations are how we model continuous time systems. That's why you spend so much time learning about differential equations. They're very, very important to how we model systems. So for the circuit shown, we can pretty easily, I hope you know, all of you could write this the equation for this circuit without too much trouble. We have R times I of t plus the voltage across the capacitor, which we'll call Y of t, minus X of t is equal to zero, just doing a simple voltage loop. So we, from this equation, we can solve for I of t, the current, as C dVc dt, what's happening with the capacitor here. And we'll just write that as C times dy of t dt, because we're going to use y for the output, and we'll use x for the input. So we can write this as R times our expression for the current, plus y of t minus x of t is equal to zero, which then gives us an equation you should be familiar with, dy of t dt plus 1 over rc times y of t is equal to 1 over rc times x of t. So if x of t is zero, you have the response due to the initial condition is just this differential equation, and then on top of that you have the component due to the input. Now if we apply a pulse to this circuit, we apply a square pulse of width delta and height 1 over delta, we can actually get the response to this circuit. In general, what is the response to this circuit going to be? Well, we would hope that if we apply a pulse to this circuit, what should the final value of the voltage across the capacitor be?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Someone said?
The voltage of the pulse.
So the pulse is short in time and eventually goes to zero. What should happen to the voltage across the capacitor?
Should go to zero.
Go to zero. So the long-term value of the circuit should be, the voltage should go to zero. What happens when I, at time zero, when I apply that pulse, when I get this rapid change in voltage, what's going to happen to the voltage across the capacitor? It'll charge up, and then it will do something along here and then eventually decay. So here we've plotted the responses for different values of delta, and you can see here for delta equals 1, you get a pretty nice view of the capacitor charging and then the capacitor discharging. And as we let delta go to 0, what is this output going to converge to? Functionally. If delta goes to zero, what happens to the amplitude?
It's gonna get zero.
So that converges to what kind of a function?
Cool.
An impulse function, right? Yeah. Therefore, if I apply this impulse function to this system, what am I getting for the output? The impulse response. And what is the impulse response of this circuit? You can remember that from your circuits. Well, we see here what's happening is this is converging to what?
Say that again.
What is this converging to? As delta decreases, you can see we go from this charge and discharge to
discharge.
Just the discharge. The impulse response of this circuit is an exponential. And in fact, the response to all first-order differential equations is essentially an exponential. So the impulse response to the circuit is an exponential. What controls the slope of the exponent, or the weight of the exponent?
RC.
The RC time constant. And we can see that it converges to that. So this is a sort of a nice demonstration of how we use a differential equation to model that circuit, and then how we can use that result to produce the impulse response. Now, and throughout the semester, you'll learn how to do this in MATLAB if you haven't already done this. We can actually solve these kinds of problems fairly easily in MATLAB, as well as I think you probably use SPICE already to do this kind of thing. Now, what I want to show you next, this is a little bit complicated, but what I'm going to show you, the bottom line is that using a difference equation, we can actually get the same solution as the continuous time solution that we showed previously. So let's take our first order differential equation, So this is just using, you could say, numerical analysis. It doesn't have to do anything to do with electrical engineering per se, but there is a nice convergence of the two. So here's our differential equation. We can solve this numerically by looking at, by replacing continuous time with n times capital T. So we're going to write the derivative as a function of n times capital T is equal to a times y of nt plus b times x of nt. Now, we have to approximate this derivative. We want to go further. So what's a reasonable way to approximate a derivative? The slope, right? So we'll take, there's actually a lot of different ways you can approximate derivatives, but for the moment, let's do something very simple. Let's take the value at time n plus 1, subtract it from the value at time n, and divide by the time, t. So we can make this substitution into this difference equation, and we have y of nt plus t minus y of nt over t is equal to minus a times y of nt plus b times x of nt. Now, we'll simplify the notation a little bit. X of nt, we write as x of n. We just sort of hide this capital T. Y of nt, we write as y of n. So we can write this as y of n plus 1 minus y of n over t is equal to minus a y of n plus b times x of n. We can then multiply it by t, and we can move the y of n over to the right-hand side, and we can write y of n plus 1 is equal to 1 minus a times t times y of n plus b times t times x of n. So that's not too bad. It's a simple algebra using an approximation for the derivative. But this is a linear time invariant system, so it's going to be convenient to write this equation to sort of re-index it by n. So we can write this as y of n. We can essentially just shift this one in time and write this as y of n is equal to 1 minus a times t times y of n minus 1 plus b times t of x of n minus 1. This is called the Euler approximation to the difference equation, to this differential equation. And
that's just a nice historical note. You could maybe use it at a party to impress somebody.
But
the other one about Euler? The approximation.
Hey, you're going to learn a lot of really useful tidbits in this class.
You'll be surprised what they come in handy with.
So there's this Hamilton circuit, right?
So we have, let's look at what happens here when x of n is equal to 0 and the initial condition is 0. Well, the solution of this equation then becomes just the response that we computed on the previous slide. It's just going to be this constant raised to the n power. So the solution of this equation, when there's essentially no input and we just have an initial condition, y of 0, is going to be 1 minus a times capital T raised to the nth power times y of 0. Now that's kind of looking interesting because the solution for the continuous time system is e to the minus at times y of 0. The solution to the discrete time system is 1 minus at raised to the nth power times y of 0. And later we'll actually show using a Laplace transform that this, if you use Laplace transform for this equation, you get this third solution, which is e to the minus a n times t times y of 0. But this e to the minus at, this can be approximated using a Taylor series as 1 minus at plus some higher order terms. So what's essentially happened here is that this differential equation, which we have approximated using a simple derivative, gives us essentially a first order approximation to this continuous time system. The discrete time solution is essentially a first order approximation to the continuous time solution. Now, if you forget this tomorrow, I won't really worry too much. But I just want to show you this. to show you that in fact we can always solve continuous time systems on the computer using these kinds of simple approximations as long as the sample instance T is small enough that we capture the dynamics of the system. And later we'll talk about that when we get to the sampling theory. But for the moment, it seems like the discrete time system and the continuous time system are behaving in a similar way. They're just linked by this approximation to the derivative. Now, we can actually use higher order derivatives to approximate such systems. Instead of using a first order derivative, we could actually, if we had a differential equation with higher order derivatives, we could follow a similar process. We could approximate a second order derivative by the difference of values for the first order derivative. And if we did that, we could actually show that that gives us an equation, a difference equation, which looks like this. We have y of n plus 2 minus 2 y of n plus 1 plus y of n over t. And there's, so you can see here that any derivative can be approximated as a difference equation. And in fact, if you go into more advanced studies in digital signal processing or numerical analysis, you'll learn all sorts of different ways to approximate derivatives. Higher order derivatives can be approximated. We can go on, we can do the third order derivative, the fourth order derivative. And therefore, arbitrary differential equations can be converted to difference equations using this technique. So the point here is that when faced with any continuous time differential equation, we can now, using difference equations, approximate that equation on the computer and find a numerical solution to that equation, simply using this technique that I showed you, which involves a very simple approximation for the derivative. Now, what alternatives do you have on a digital computer if you want to solve continuous time differential equations? How have you been doing that previously?
MATLAB.
You can use, and what are you using inside of MATLAB?
Symbolic.
The symbolic toolbox, right? Or some of you may have used Mathematica or some of those tools. An alternate way to solve this continuous time systems are to use symbolic toolboxes that do the manipulations symbolically. Those things didn't exist 20, 30 years ago when this kind of stuff was developed. And still, if you may find that those packages do not work well when you're dealing with very complex differential equations. So the many different areas of engineering will use these kinds of numerical approximations for solving these equations. You will also sometimes, if you're building like real-time digital controllers and things, use a similar kind of approximation. We'll see that towards the end of the semester. MATLAB fortunately supports both symbolic and numerical solutions, so you have a lot of options with how you can solve these differential equations. Derivatives are quite tricky to compute for discrete time signals. However, in addition to the differences methods shown above, there are some other methods that involve statistical regression. And later in the course, we'll consider the implications of differentiation in the frequency domain. Now, why are derivatives difficult to compute for discrete time signals? Well, what does the, generally speaking, from a frequency response point of view, though I know we haven't talked too much about frequency response yet, if you have a signal and you differentiate it, let's say you have a signal that has a spectrum. You know, most signals in the real world kind of have a spectrum which rolls off between some frequency. So this is, we haven't talked yet about frequency response, but I think you all have some familiarity with this. What happens if you differentiate this signal? What do you think is going to happen to the spectrum qualitatively?
Well,
what is the differentiation doing to a signal?
It's going to turn into a straight line.
So if this is a signal, and let's say the signal just happens to have,
it doesn't really affect the frequency, does it?
This kind of a spectrum. So when you take a signal and you differentiate it, what are you doing? Point by point. You're essentially doing what?
Taking the
slope, the instantaneous slope of the signal, right? You're measuring the change. So do you think that decreases or increases the high frequency content of that signal?
Shouldn't it just mess with the phase shift?
And you're all, you know, so you're not, you're laughing now about this, but believe me, in the senior design lab about midnight some night, you're going to be thankful I told you about this, because you're going to try to differentiate a signal and you're going to be shocked at what comes out of the circuit. If you measure is the instantaneous slope of this signal changing slowly or quickly?
Quickly,
right? So if you look at the derivative of this signal, is it going to have high frequency, more high frequency content or less high frequency content?
More.
In fact, we're going to find later in the semester that differentiation is a process which amplifies significantly high frequencies. So if you take a signal up in the lab and you differentiate it, what's going to come out is noise. And I always enjoy when students do this for the first time and they think, oh, the circuit's broken or something. It's very, and you may have some idea of some algorithm that's going to use this. A lot of algorithms want to use derivatives. These are not easy to compute in the real world because they amplify the noise in the signal tremendously because they amplify all the high frequency information. So it's a nice mathematical concept, but we have to be very careful about how we implement this in practice. And these kinds of differencing circuits are actually pretty effective at doing that. So this ability to solve differential equations numerically is very useful to us, and it becomes the basis for digital controls, for example, if some of you are going to go on and take the discrete time control course later in your curriculum. So let's come back to our RC circuit and see what happens. We have this differential equation. We have now a difference equation approximation for this differential equation based on the equation that we previously derived. And we can actually compare the solution that we get with the difference equation to this true solution that we get through analytical techniques. So here we have the exact solution as the solid line, and the circles represent the solution that we get using the Euler approximation, using essentially the first order difference. And I think there's a dotted line here which represents another approximation for the solution of the equation. But you can see that the two converge pretty closely, and in fact, the more you increase the sample instant, capital T, the closer these two lines are going to get. But you know, even at this point, the solutions agreed fairly well, but one was found numerically and one was found analytically. So that will hopefully increase your confidence in the solutions that you get numerically when you try to solve differential equations using difference equations. So let's extend this a little bit further and talk about how we represent continuous time systems, signals using this kind of discrete approximation. So if you recall from calculus, we approximated a function by a sum of time shifted scale pulse functions. You may remember when you derived integration, you did something like this and then you let the width of these bins go to zero. We can approximate a signal's amplitude as a constant over the interval. So we'll assume that the signal takes on a constant value over this range, and that allows us to write an approximation for the signal as taking on the value x of k times delta, where delta is this width, k is the index of the bin. And this then becomes a staircased or discrete time approximation
to this signal. And if we now let delta go to zero, obviously this signal will converge to the true signal, and that's essentially what happens when we talk about discrete time signals and continuous time signals. Now the interesting thing and the really amazing thing about discrete time signals is we're going to show that there's a magical value for this width related to the frequency content of the signal. But if you make this width small enough, you can actually throw away the signal and only retain the values of the signal at the sample instances, and you can essentially have the full representation of the signal, so you can recover the original signal even though you're throwing away a lot of it. That's essentially how these audio players work. They take an analog signal, they sample it, they store only the sample values, they reconstruct the analog signal when you play back, and the two sound very, very close to one another. That's a process that's very similar to what I'm showing here, and the trick is that you have to choose this step size to be small enough that it captures the variations in the signal, and that later we will show is something called the sampling theorem, and it tells us how to compute delta, how to choose that width, so that we can properly reconstruct the signal. And that innovation, which was first shown back in the mid-1900s, is really what gave, what sort of invented the whole field of digital signal processing. Yep.
Why does the sampling size impact, with music, the ability to reproduce certain frequencies better than other frequencies?
That's the sampling theorem. So the sampling theorem will tell us is that this sample frequency, this distance, if you take 1 over this distance, you can think of that as a frequency, that has to be greater than twice the highest frequency in the signal. So 44.1 kilohertz sampled data, which is what these MP3 players use, you can represent up to about 22 kilohertz of analog information. Now, if you're a purist, you say, well, music contains frequencies higher than 22 kilohertz. Human hearing goes up to about 30 kilohertz. Your dog's hearing goes up to about 40 kilohertz.
Yeah, right.
And if you've been to too many rock concerts in your lifetime, you may be down to 20 kilohertz already.
Like 15.
I was reading an article about the guy in Metallica over the weekend, and 30 years of being in Metallica, and amazingly, his hearing is still intact. It's amazing. But generally speaking, your hearing is good out to about 25, 30 kilohertz, but in the music industry, they decided to preserve disk space to limit things to about 22 kilohertz. So the shorter you make this interval, the higher the frequency content you can represent. And we'll go through all the details of that. It's really a really nice, elegant proof of how the two relate.
Is that why as you lower the bit rate of an MP3, stuff like cymbals get damaged
yep.
right before the load?
Yep. Anything that's high frequency is going to get low pass filtered. Very, very good. Also, it's interesting if you change the compression rates. Well, it doesn't necessarily change the bandwidth. It adds noise and that kind of thing. And we'll talk a little bit about that towards the end of the semester. But there's no substitute for sampling at a very high rate. Of course, that costs you a lot of disk space. So we've now got a way to represent a continuous time signal as a value x of k times delta times some delta function. And we can write then that approximation for our signal x of t, x hat of t, is simply a sum of these samples of the signal times these pulse functions. And then we can let delta, the width, go to zero, and we can write that x of t is essentially a collection of these impulse functions. So this is essentially how we represent, as we discussed, how we represent analog signals digitally by simply using a fairly short or a small pulse. So in the continuous time case, the key that we represent signals using these impulse functions, and in the discrete time case, we represent signals using these pulse functions. Now, we don't actually have to do this analysis using a rectangular pulse. We can actually use a triangular pulse or a Gaussian pulse. The key thing is just that the pulse have vanishingly small width. And it's interesting that if you take a course in communication theory, such as a course dealing with transmission over optical fibers and things, you'll actually hear a lot about Gaussian pulses, Gaussian-shaped pulses, where the shape is now a Gaussian as opposed to a rectangle, are actually used extensively when you're dealing with optical communication systems. It's one of the ways they're able to transmit digital signals over longer lengths in a fiber. But for this class, we'll just simply use this rectangle approximation and use the impulse functions that we've introduced. So what we've talked about, we hit on a number of topics today, but we're basically building your background in how we're going to represent signal systems. It all really begins with representing a system as a differential equation. If you if you're studying a problem for the first time, you will often sit down with people who understand the physics of the problem very well, and you'll write some kind of differential equation that describes the system. In your physics classes, you learned about springs and masses, for example. Springs and masses are the equivalents of your simple electric circuits. If you took a course in fluids, you would find that you have very simple models of fluids flowing through pipes and things like that, which are also modeled, much like we model circuits, as first-order differential equations. Then we talked about the equivalent of those in the discrete world, what we call a linear constant coefficient difference equation. And a difference equation can be something very simple, like the process of taking a line and computing the average at every point. You can actually think of that as a difference equation, and we'll show you that specific technique later in the semester when we talk about low-pass filters. Then we showed you how we can solve differential equations using numerical techniques. Using difference equations, we can actually get approximate solutions for differential equations, and the key thing there was to convert a derivative to a difference. And we showed you how to do that using one particular approximation, what's called a first-order difference, but there's actually many different ways you can do that approximation, and you'll study those if you go on into the DSP class, for example. And then we actually compared the accuracy of the analytic and the approximate solution for an RC circuit, and we showed that the two are related by the fact that the difference equation result was simply a first-order approximation to the continuous time result for the RC circuit. And then finally, we introduced a method for representing continuous time signals as a combination of impulse functions. So now we have discrete time signals, which are a combination of unit pulse functions, and we have continuous time signals, which can be thought of as a combination of impulse functions. So the two ultimately work together. It's not one or the other, but both of these essentially describe the same information. We could choose to describe that information in the analog world or in the digital world, but there's no real difference between the two representations. Okay, so I think that's it for today. And on Friday, what we're going to do is we're going to introduce continuous time convolution, and then you'll work some examples with the Java applet on convolution.
Eggman.